You're listening to Irish Radio Canada's Home and Abroad, and we've been talking about County Wicklow this weekend, and we've been talking about the connection between Culloden and Canada, and then we heard a little from some music from John Hogan, and now we're going to hear more about Wicklow, because it's going to span the famine plus. And the famine plus in that there's an excellent archive down in New Brunswick which gives drew my attention to a book by Jim Reeves. Jim has, back, it's now 25 years ago since the book was published, but he has that, and he has another initiative he's working on, which is an historic towns initiative. And we're going to talk about that as well, because that, when he and I talked, I found out to be a fascinating project. But, Jim, first of all, welcome. And we're going to talk initially about surplus people from Wicklow to Canada. Ta Fáilte, Rose.
Yeah, thank you, Austin.
So, I know it's been a while, but back when you did the research on this, and some of the things I was surprised at or wasn't aware of was that when the migration happened, and Will Fitzwilliam assisted the passage of about 6,000, that he was getting his tenants or the people around on the farm from 20,000 down to 14,000. They're huge numbers.
Vast numbers. But then the estate itself was so big. In the 1840s, the Culloden estate consisted of 70,000 acres. By the time, by the end of the century, coming up to 1900, it had actually increased to 90,000 acres. It represented 1/6 of the entire County Wicklow. So you can imagine hundreds of townlands on it, hundreds of people within each of those townlands. So we are talking about massive numbers. And in that 10-year period of 1847 to 1856, there were 6,000 of his tenants cleared off the estate as part of the, as the result of the famine, basically.
And was there, I know my understanding was Fitzwilliam was probably the largest landowner in Ireland, that was the biggest estate, as I understand it.
Yeah, I think there might have been one more over west, over in Galway. It's something like little over 100,000 acres, but it was very poor land.
Right.
Rocky in some places, boggy in others, whereas the Fitzwilliam land was good land. And it's a massive, certainly it was the biggest estate of excellent land.
So when it came to clearing 6,000, was it from what you were able to research or establish, was it from a particular area, was it random across, or was it that the particular people met an unfortunate criteria?
Yeah, it was strange, and it's very hard to pinpoint this. It's a great question, and I wish I had a great answer, but it was right across the estate. It wasn't just a few selected pockets here and there. It was right across. And the best thing about the Fitzwilliam estate is the record keeping on the Fitzwilliam estate for 300 years is absolutely brilliant. Only the Nazis get better records without bringing the analogy.
Okay.
But that is why we know exactly what went on the estate over that period. And it was very, very strange that if you were a tenant on an estate such as the Fitzwilliam estate and you were in rent arrears, you could be evicted. You were in arrears, you could be evicted. But he couldn't actually, nobody had a right to send you out of the country.
Right.
But he could kick you off the estate. And to be honest, the Fitzwilliams weren't the worst of landlords. They weren't the worst at all. Or in fact, they were among the best. I've often described them as, I find it very hard still to put the word good and landlord into the same sentence. But they were among the best of a bad bunch, we put it that way. And they did, in lots of estates, people were just kicked off their holding, and they could either go to the workhouse or they could starve or do whatever, but they were off the estate. And the Fitzwilliams didn't do that. In fact, they arranged passage to Canada. And they actually funded that. Now, before we start thinking this was Santa Claus in disguise, I'll just expand on that now in a second. But they did make arrangements. Now, when they came to see, I'll come back to that thing about the passage in a minute. But when they came to decide who got rid of and who was going to be retained, they went around each people that they said, right, we need so many from that townland out of there, so many out of there, and so on. And people were given the option to go. You didn't have to go, and he couldn't make you. But let's be honest. If you were in the late 1840s Ireland, and you were given an option of free passage across the Atlantic or go into the workhouse, which you're going to take?
Mm-hmm.
Also, what he did with a lot of landlords did not do, he, when they chartered the ships, and most of them went from New Ross in County Wexford, when they chartered the ships, Fitzwilliam insisted that to be medically examined both when they were leaving Ireland and again to be medically examined when they arrived in Canada.
Mm.
An awful lot of people didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the medical examinations were kind of harmless, but the point is, it was a stipulation they had. For a start, with ship fever, you could be examined getting on board a ship and you're perfectly healthy. But the typhus and everything else could be inside you, incubating, and it wouldn't really break out until you're 4 or 5 days into the voyage, and that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
As well as that, I know that in Liverpool medical examinations, I worked it out with a calculator one time, there were so many people living in the ports like Liverpool, and the medical offices were only open for 6 hours a day, but each medical examination lasted about 1.3 seconds.
Right.
Good going, you know.
Yeah.
But Fitzwilliam, they did try the best on that.
Right. And the other thing then would have been that it was families were going. So it wasn't just a case of that it was the males that were being sent. So in assisting passage, as you pointed out there, if you're being given an option to get out of a bad situation in Ireland due to the famine, it's not just you. It's you're saying we're willing to give you an opportunity for the whole family.
Yes, yes. And that is very, very important. And in fact, not only the immediate family, in the townland you lived, your brother and his family might be just down the road, and they got the option as well. So you could have extended, and in many cases you had extended families.
Right.
And it backfired in one instance. And it was very good because then you have that mutual support and everything else on the crossing over and when you get there. And that was very good. But where it backfired? In 1847, one of the ships, all the ships that were chartered in that 10-year period went into Quebec. But in 1847, there was one exception to it, and it went to New Brunswick. And there was a railway line being built from St. Andrews in New Brunswick up to Quebec. Fitzwilliam was very, very interested in railways. It was railway fever at the time, late 1840s. And he was very interested in buying into this whole opening of the railway system over in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So what he did, he contacted the railway company in New Brunswick, and it was agreed that he would send out 100 workers to there, and he would pay their passage. And not only that, he said that I will pay their wages for the first 3 months until they get settled. But again, it looks very philanthropic until you look at the details behind it. To do what he was doing, send out 100 workers and pay their wages, was going to cost about £1,000 at the time. Now, Fitzwilliam used that to get £1,000 worth of shares in the new railway company. So he paid their wages all right, but he got these shares, and he ended up that he was the biggest British Rock Eye, well, he was a British landlord, the biggest British shareholder in that railway line. Not only that, going back to this family connection, Fitzwilliam would not send out just able-bodied workers, able-bodied men to work on the railway line. He sent out their families as well. So instead of 100 able-bodied workers arriving in New Brunswick to go on the railway, 100 families went out, nearly 400 people, men, women, children, and a lot of the men were sick or elderly. So the railway company just said, no, this feels off. We didn't do this at all. So the people arrived and there was no accommodation available, as had been agreed. It was going to be a shanty town built for the 100 workers. But when they got out there, even that shanty town didn't exist, and there certainly wasn't accommodation for nearly 400 people arriving. So that is one instance where a whole family went instead of an individual member of the family.
And then, you know, when I understand as well that the conditions when they arrived, while their passage was paid, it wasn't a bit that like the Robinson migration, where they were given the opportunity of land and they were given clothing and they were given provisions. That literally, as I understand it, when they arrived out, now, okay, we got you here. Go work on the railway if you're a worker, but you have to fend for yourself.
Yes. Yes. And the reason for that, that comes down partly to the railway companies in Canada, not just on this side, on both sides, that there was a proposal in that New Brunswick to Quebec line where they would want, they were looking for specifically for Scottish workers or Protestant Irish workers. They would be allocated land along the side of the railway track, but Catholics wouldn't be. They didn't want Irish Catholic workers working on the railway line. That's a very important point, and that's in the Canadian Railway Company's attitude, as well as it is to an awful lot of the attitudes in among Irish landlords.
Right.
The reason, and the other reason why landlords chose to get rid of an awful lot of the tenants in, from 1847 on, up to 1847, that any tenants who were on your, if you had tenants on your estate and they went into the workhouse, well, that was hard luck. They were off your estate, so your hands were washed. You had no more responsibility for them. There was a change in the law in 1847 where if tenants went into the workhouse or looked for free food or anything else like that, then the landlord would have to pay with increased rates. So it actually became economically makes sense to make a one-off payment in shipping these people out to Canada,
right,
wherever, just right, get rid of them rather right than ongoing payments to support the poorhouse.
Right. I'm going to shift gear, but before we do, if you want to read Surplus People from Wicklow to Canada, you can find a copy and read it, and it is in the beautiful archives, the Fitzwilliam Estate Immigration Books 1847 to 1856, which are part of the New Brunswick Archives. So if you actually do a Google search for the New Brunswick Archives and the Fitzwilliam Estate, it'll bring you to a page, and it has there's a database in there with all the names, a whole variety of stuff. As I say, fascinating indeed what you can find. And Jim's book, is there's a link over to it as well. But I want to switch gear and talk about the Historic Towns Initiative that you've been involved in. And give me a little bit of an overview of what that is.
Yeah, it's a kind of a complicated one. It's Europe-wide, and it's been on the go for about 40 years. But it, like most of these things, it takes a while to get a bit of impetus underway. And at the moment, there are about 1,000 towns done across Europe, a few in England. But in Ireland now, I think we're coming up to about 100 towns been done. And I'm doing the Arklow Town Atlas. What it is, any Irish town that of 1,000 people or over, local historians are invited to, it's been run here by the Royal Irish Academy in Dublin, and local historians are invited, would they compile the Historic Towns Atlas for their town? Now, it is the most satisfying and the most frustrating project I have ever done in my life. I would prefer to sit down and write three books, because what you do is you get all the information and all the sources of information. Now, normally you would use that information then to write a narrative story. There's no narrative story here. All you're doing is, if we take what I'm doing with Arklow, and it's the same across all the other towns that are being done, you look at the different infrastructure that's there. If it's a port town like Arklow, when did the port develop? When did the bridges develop? Canals, railway systems, when different trades, when can you find the earliest forge and blacksmith in your area? When did your main street and the other streets develop? How did the town slowly build up over maybe 1,000 years? And how you do that is you go back through all the medieval documents, you go back through local newspapers, all this, and you get the earliest reference to each thing. And you get all the references. So you would have, what is coming out then is a folder full of references and dates. And one of the strikes me just off the top of my head is, yesterday, in fact, I came across when the first dentist set up in Arklow. So I would put down dentistry, such and such a date, set up at such and such an address. But that's it. You move on then. And it's really, obviously, this is not something you would sit down for an enjoyable read. It would be about an entertaining read as a telephone book. But it's the information is what matters. And it's there. It's a researcher's tool. They want to go in. I want to find out about something in this town, this aspect or that aspect. And everything's there. And it will tell you where the information is. That's what we're doing.
And Jim, where is this being made available, or where has it been stored?
Well, I'm still in the progress of doing mine. The ARPA one won't be published for about another 2 years. It takes about 10 years on average, one of these. And if, for anybody who's interested, if they Google the Royal Irish Academy, RIA, be very good. I have to be careful when I'm telling people I'm actually now working with the RIA. I never discuss it if I have a pint. So it's Royal Irish Academy, Historic Irish Historic Towns Atlas, IHTA, and you will get all the information there. And some of your listeners, your town might already be done.
Indeed.
And it is a fast, and you can get it online, you can get it in digital form, you can get it in hard copy, but that's where you get it. Google RIA. IHTA.
Fantastic. Jim, it's been fascinating and wonderful meeting you, and thank you so much for taking the time. I've learned, and I hope the listener gets the opportunity to learn from it, and at least we're pointing them in the direction of where they can go for more information.
Thank you, Austin.